Thanks so much. My name is Amandeep Sidhu, and I'm a partner in the Washington, D.C. office of Winston & Strawn in our healthcare and life sciences practice. Thank you all for joining us for the next installment in our healthcare and life sciences M&A webinar series. Today's program is focused on fraud and abuse issues in healthcare services transactions. At the end of the program, we'll give you a preview of the additional programs we have on the slate for 2021, but we really appreciate you all taking time to join us today to go through some of the key fraud and abuse issues that me and my colleague Guy Collier would like to cover with you this afternoon or this morning, depending on the time zone from where you are joining us. Just in terms of logistics for today's program, we are providing CLE credit, and there will be 2 points during the presentation when we will provide a slide and read a code that you will need in order to obtain CLE credit. So please pay attention to that. Again, as I mentioned, I'm joined by my colleague also in the Washington, D.C. office, Guy Collier. By way of brief background, my practice is one that covers compliance and regulatory issues, investigations, and litigation in the healthcare and life sciences industries. For today's program, we're going to go through recent trends that we've seen in healthcare M&A, considerations that we should focus on when structuring deals, and then provide an overview of fraud and abuse laws that that we focus on when we're going through due diligence during the outset of a transactional deal. We're going to cover the anti-kickback statute, Stark Law, the False Claims Act, civil monetary penalties, and HIPAA. And we're also going to spend a little bit of time covering changes that were recently adopted by the Health and Human Services Office of Inspector General and CMS with regard to the anti-kickback statute, the Stark Law, and civil monetary penalties. With that intro, I'm going to hand off to my colleague, Guy Collier, to take us through recent trends in healthcare M&A. Guy?
Thank you, Amin, and welcome, everybody. We really appreciate your making the time to be with us today, and I hope everyone is doing well under the circumstances. So today, as Amin said, we want to give you a little bit of an environmental scan on the world of healthcare M&A, what's happening with transactions generally, and then a little bit of counseling on how to deal with potential fraud and abuse issues in transactions, the common mechanisms that we use for dealing with those, addressing those. And then we're going to spend a little time on the underlying statutes that you have to be so concerned about in healthcare transactions. So, Amin, you can go to the next slide. All right, here's some of the current trends. Interestingly, M&A activity remained pretty strong through 2019. I'll give you a graphic in a couple of minutes. It is down a little bit, as would be expected in 2020, but still, relatively strong given the pandemic. We note here that the Affordable Care Act, the ACA, continues to affect M&A activity because of downward pressures on reimbursement and the pressure to develop different alternative payment models like value-based care. And that will only continue. We received the announcement within the last couple of days about the GEO initiative coming out from Medicare that will be out soon that will look at assembling groups of providers by geographic area beginning in January 2022. They'll have, I think, 10 to 14 areas where they do this demonstration project and have, that collection of providers manage Medicare Part A and Part B beneficiaries in that geographic area. It will not include Medicare Advantage, nor will it include Medicare Part D. So lots of innovation continuing to come out of CMS. And I think you can just look at the environment and see that, people are still continuing to look at various types of affiliation to manage care better and achieve economies of scale. Sanford Health in their negotiations with Intermountain will be a major, you know, combination of two nonprofit systems. This past year, we saw Wake Forest Baptist Health down in North Carolina join with Atrium, a very, very large nonprofit system in North and South Carolina and Georgia. And again, to achieve economies of scale, in the case of academics, to spread the extraordinary costs of academic medicine across a much larger revenue base. So we expect those to continue. We also see on the private equity side, we see deals that we did 3 or 4 years ago, you know, now being flipped to new purchasers. So that will continue. As we note here on the slide, the push towards innovation continues. We got notice this week of the new rapid coronavirus test that will be available over the counter to be, you know, widely accessible. And I think that's only indicative of what we'll continue to see, driven, you know, in some part, of course, by the pandemic. Private equity continues to be strong. And the impact of COVID-19 is interesting. I mean, we've seen a lot of innovation, of course, around the vaccines. We've seen innovation around certain care delivery models that get to patients in the home to screen them there and perhaps keep them out of a hospital emergency room unnecessarily. So some very innovative structures that are being driven by COVID. We had 3 or 4 academic medicine transactions that hit a grinding halt in the middle of COVID just because those folks were dealing with the pandemic and taking care of patients from, you know, their catchment areas. And we fully expect once we get on the backside of the pandemic that those transactions will pick up and begin to move. And the last point would be the rise of telemedicine. We've had telemedicine, of course, for many, many years, some innovative programs like the ECHO project out at the University of New Mexico to step out tertiary and quaternary care to rural outlying areas in a rural state like New Mexico, and many others, you know, telestroke programs, many of the major academic medical centers. But we saw a tremendous reliance on telemedicine and a flexibility by the regulators in dealing with telemedicine and the reimbursement for telemedicine services. So we all think that that will be a phenomenon that stays with us post-pandemic. Okay, Amin, next slide, please. All right, continued trends. There are still, you know, risks associated with fraud and abuse in all transactions. In 2019, as we note on this slide, the government recovered $2.6 billion in healthcare fraud-related settlements and judgments. So this is still a you know, a bit of a growth industry for the government. It's been strong for years. It continues to be strong. And it's a bipartisan issue on the Hill. It's probably one of the few that is bipartisan. It's a bit of a motherhood issue on the Hill. As we note in the second bullet point, we'll talk in a little more detail as we go through this, but due diligence is absolutely essential to evaluate and mitigate your risk in any of these healthcare transactions. And as we note here, particularly where you're dealing with a smaller company, maybe the target is smaller and does not have great infrastructure, has limited resources and staff, and either has no compliance program or a very meager compliance program, and perhaps is dealing in one of the areas that does have risk, all the more important to do very significant, very thorough due diligence on that target. Okay, next slide, Amin. All right, here's some of the statistics, and this is from the Irving Levin deal book that comes out the last year of full data, of course, 2019, $3.9 trillion in global M&A. Of that, $403 billion, or 1,785 deals were in the healthcare space. The majority of those, 1,232, were in healthcare services, with about 553 in life sciences, biotech, medical devices, pharma. So the takeaway is that while down a little bit from our Q4 18 deal flow did remain strong through 2019. And while it's not on the slide, deals in Q2 of 2020, there were about 341 deals, were down roughly 25% from the same quarter in 2019, which again is not unexpected. So the deal flow did not die, but it was of course diminished in 2020. Interestingly, the value of the deals in 2020 is dramatically higher. Those in Q3 of 2020 compared with both Q2 of 2020 and Q3 of 2019 were dramatically higher. So we're seeing a much higher value in the deals that are going forward. So still a robust area in the healthcare economy. Okay, next slide, Amin. All right, this just shows you where the deal activity was by subsector in 2019. And lion's share of deals up in the long-term care sector, as those of you who work in long-term care know, there are literally thousands and thousands of long-term care facilities. There are REITs involved in that space. There are, very significant for-profit operators like Genesis. There are many, many, many nonprofit and faith-based operators, but it is a large sector of the healthcare space, and a large part of the facilities in the healthcare sector. So not surprising that many of the deals were there. Physician medical groups, 183 hospitals, only 93 deals that hit the radar in 2019, and it goes on down. You can see on the slide, but just gives you some sense for where the deals are in the healthcare sector in 2019, the last year of full data. All right, Amin, if you can advance. All right, just some of the examples of things that you need to be concerned about when dealing in this space, healthcare M&A transactions, overbilling, billing for services that aren't rendered, either fabricating patient claims or adding charges, upcoding where you bill more than is warranted, you bill for more expensive services or codes than those actually provided, unbundling where a procedure is disaggregated and billed as if it were separate procedures, and then, of course, kickbacks, which we'll talk about in some detail today, offering either a naked kickback or really anything of value for the steerage or the referral of patients, which is, of course, a problem, big problem. Just to digress here a little, we'll try not to tell war stories, but one of my personal favorites in this space, some years ago, we were working with a publicly traded long-term care chain that was positioning itself for sale to a publicly traded rehab long-term care combo chain. And our client had decided that their, if I recall, Medicare Part B billings were really, really deficient, that they had not been claiming and billing things that were, in fact, allowable. And so they went back and did an exercise known euphemistically as the retro bill, where they looked back through the last 18 months of billings and tried to see, everything that could possibly be rebilled on the Medicare Part B side. They stepped this down in the billing and reimbursement department to the lowest possible level. A newish clerk started going through claims and saw something called a trach kit, tracheostomy kit, and she saw another code for trach care. Well, trach care is a twice-a-day thing where the trach kit or the trach is, cleaned out by the tech. And at the time, it was a sort of a $30 item, happened a couple of times a day. The trach kit is the actual tracheotomy supplies, gloves, alcohol, trach tube, everything that's involved in inserting the trach. And that's a kind of a once a month, maybe twice a month deal, and it's roughly triple the reimbursement. So this clerk, not appreciating the difference, went back and recoded every trach care for the past 18 months as a trach kit, which led to billings that were triple, quadruple, quintuple the amount that they had billed. So of course this set off all sorts of bells and whistles at the Medicare Part B carrier. And that's when we got called in. We did an investigation with PricewaterhouseCoopers. We pinned down what had happened here. This was in the days when you could sort of walk this in to the U.S. Attorney's Office, which we did. And we sat down with the U.S. Attorney, explained what had happened here. And the immortal line that I'll never forget, our local counsel, who was a former attorney general of the state, but also a fabulous trial lawyer, one of the best I've ever encountered, leaned across the desk to his friend, the U.S. attorney, and said, "John, we've known each other a long time. This was simply too stupid to be fraudulent." So with that, we settled for about 1.5 times the amount of damages. And don't know that it would be that simple today, but the takeaway is that this is the sort of thing that happens in a large multi-facility company, and it's the sort of thing you've got to find before you acquire that company or before you get too far down the road and doing a deal with them. So enough on the retro bill. Next slide. All right, keep going if you will. All right, what are some of the considerations to structuring a deal? As we say, you know, cut off, avoid, you know, liability for things that happen, you know, pre-closing to the extent you can. So how do you do that? You do it through very robust due diligence that, you know, is absolutely critical as you're structuring the deal, determining the price, if there is in fact a price, and mitigating risk. And while other regulatory areas are, you know, important as well, environmental, you know, tax, employee benefits, compliance with fraud and abuse is absolutely critical due to both the potential penalties and the ability to continue receiving reimbursement from the public reimbursement programs. So it really should be at the top of the list. And as Amin will go into in some more detail when he goes through some of the critical laws here, most of the laws are focused on protecting patients from some inappropriate influence, respecting their independent medical judgment and that of physicians. Steerage cases, you know, outright, you know, bribery or kickback cases that unduly influence the choice of the physician or the patient. They're also intended to really promote systems and controls that ensure accurate billing and compliance oversight to identify any irregularities like the famous retro bill. And where you discover those, perhaps consider a self-disclosure to either CMS or OIG, depending on the nature of the problem. Okay, next slide, Amin. Okay, so how do you do all this? As you're doing your definitive agreement, whether it's an asset purchase agreement, a merger agreement, or whatever, absolutely bake in strong reps and warranties into that definitive agreement. You'll have the standard compliance with all applicable laws that says, you know, they have complied with everything, both state, you know, federal, local, that bears on their business, but more particularly, really get a specific rep on compliance with the full range of the fraud and abuse statutes here, the anti-kickback statute, the Stark Law, the Civil Monetary Penalties Law, HIPAA, the False Claims Act, everything that may, you know, come to bear here, get a rep on compliance with those things, and a rep on billing compliance that, you know, they have billed in accordance with all applicable standards, guidelines, sub-regulatory guidance, statutes, and regulations. And then that they have no knowledge of pending or threatened governmental investigations. Now, if one is actually in process, they will know about it. There shouldn't be a knowledge qualifier there. But it's entirely possible that one is ongoing, either a QTAM that's under seal or something that's in the early investigative stage that they don't actually know about. So there may be a knowledge qualifier there. But again, to the best of their knowledge upon due inquiry, you know, no pending or threatened governmental investigations. So you take the snapshot, you know, they've given you the rep and the warranty, you take the snapshot, and what do you do with that? Well, ideally, you have it survive. And what is the period of survival? Ideally, you would like to see a 6-year period, given the fact that that is the basic statute of limitations under the Civil False Claims Act, 10 years in the event of obfuscation or other fraud, but generally a 6-year statute of limitations. It is somewhat unusual to get a full 6-year survival period. It's negotiable, but you want that to be as long as you can to protect you from, you know, potential False Claims Act actions. And then you ask for indemnification of you as the acquirer for those pre-closing liabilities, that is a breach of the reps and warranties by the acquiree. You might consider if this is a, you know, asset sale, cash transaction, possible escrow of some portion of the purchase price. I've seen escrows that are set up and then have a declining balance over time on the theory that in the out years, your risks are declining to some degree. But some combination of indemnification and or escrow of the purchase price is a good, you know, potential protection. Now, where you've got a non-cash transaction, and a lot of the ones we do in the nonprofit space are really, you know, simply governance changes or member substitutions, you're obviously not going to be able to escrow part of the purchase price. I have seen people set up, you know, trusts to deal with, you know, this sort of risk in the out years. But again, it's you won't be able to technically escrow part of the purchase price where there really is no cash changing hands. Next slide, Amin. All right. Now, some particular difficulties. If your acquiree is disappearing at or shortly after closing, this is obviously problematic because they're not going to be around. When does this happen? It happens in a true merger. We did one a few years ago where a client acquired all of the clinical operations of a large, you know, research university, and it was set up as a true merger. So they merged their two hospitals and several hundred physicians and three managed care plans into us. And once that happened, they were gone as an entity. We've had others where we acquire. The acquired entity stays in place for some very limited period of time to, you know, pay off known liabilities, and then they dissolve. So what does that mean? It means that in those cases, due diligence is all that much more important because they're not going to be there to backstop a liability post-closing. So very, very, very critical to due diligence in those deals that is really deep and sufficient. And you'll need to involve, you know, all your other subject matter experts. We've been talking about fraud and abuse, but, you know, pensions, employee benefits, tax liabilities, outstanding bond financing, environmental liabilities in case they're sitting on a toxic waste dump. You know, all those things are important. But really, in a healthcare deal, you're going to need to dig on the fraud and abuse side, looking at every physician agreement, every agreement with a potential referral source, their billing practices, you know, possibly a subcontract to a billing specialty firm that can do a probe, you know, audit, probe sampling of their billing over a requisite period of time to see if they basically, if they get it right, if they do it right. So again, particularly in the deals where your seller will disappear at or shortly after closing, absolutely critical to do due diligence of that nature. You can't give it short shrift. Okay, let me talk for just a few minutes about the anti-kickback statute. Amin, you can advance these, and then I'll hand it off to Amin for the other heavy hitters. Okay, the anti-kickback statute is, of course, a criminal law. It's a felony. It prohibits the knowing and willful payment of remuneration to induce or reward patient referrals or generate business in any of the healthcare programs. And that involves drug supplies or healthcare services for Medicare and Medicaid patients. Interestingly, the AKS extends to all federal healthcare programs except the federal employee health benefits program, which Congress carved out for some reason that I've never been able to understand. But all other federal programs are subject to the anti-kickback statute. Remuneration of anything of value, it can be cash, it can be services in kind, it can be an opportunity. It can literally be anything of value, as we note here on the slide. And it's a bi-directional statute. It covers the payers or the offerors who offer or pay remuneration, as well as the recipients of those amounts of remuneration. So, again, remember, it's bi-directional. In some industries, it's absolutely acceptable to reward those who refer business to you, but in the federal healthcare programs, it's a crime. And one of the examples I use for my law students when we talk about the anti-kickback statute, what constitutes remuneration, is, you know, donuts and coffee in the doctor's lounge. You know, you're in a nice hospital, you've got a great medical staff, you've got a nice, you know, medical staff lounge. You, the hospital, provide, you know, Dunkin' Donuts and nice Starbucks coffee every morning. Well, is that remuneration? Yes. It's something of value you provide to your referral sources. Is it intended, at least in any part at all, to induce the referral of business? Yeah. Yeah. You want your doctors to stay with you. But would it be prosecuted by any prosecutor in America? No. No. It's all about prosecutorial discretion. But the short answer is basically everything is remuneration, and it may well have the intent to induce the referral of federal program business. You have to, you know, look at the scienter, whether or not there was guilty knowledge, and obviously at the quantum, is it enough to really affect anybody's, you know, sound judgment? Okay, next slide. Violations are punishable by both fines and imprisonment of up to 5 years or both, and people do go to prison under the statute, including hospital administrators. So it is just civil. I mean, it's just serious as a heart attack. Under the civil monetary penalties law, which I'm going to speak about, you're also subject to exclusion from the federal health care programs and to civil monetary penalties of up to $50,000 per violation and treble the amount of the remuneration that was offered, paid, solicited, or received. So double whammy, criminal prosecution and civil fines that are imposed administratively. Next slide. There are safe harbors, which I'm going to talk about in a little more detail, created both by the statute itself and by regulation. When this statute was enacted, Congress realized that, you know, they had to provide some guidance as to activities that would be, you know, generally permissible if done correctly, and therefore the agency was tasked with creating safe harbor regulations. Those regulations cover a broad range of business transactions, which are deemed to be immune from prosecution as long as you fit all aspects of the safe harbor. One of the common elements here is an arm's length transaction at fair market value, whether it's an employment arrangement, a discount, a lease, the things we note on the slides here. Is it a true arm's length transaction? Is there fair market value compensation going back and forth between the parties? We note that the AKS applies only to federal health care programs except for FEHBP, but many states have adopted their own version of an anti-kickback statute, which they'll refer to as something like an all-payer statute that gets at those other payer relationships that are not covered by the anti-kickback statute. Now, one of the criticisms of the safe harbors over the years is that they immunize conduct that no one really cares about. In other words, that no prosecutor in America would ever pursue. Nevertheless, they do afford a not just a measure of protection, but immunity if you're in the four corners of that safe harbor. And more importantly, if even if you're not in the four corners of the safe harbor, they are a tremendous guidepost as to the things that OIG does care about, you know, compensation, remuneration that doesn't vary with the value or volume of referrals, for example. All right, next slide, Haman. Okay, the Affordable Care Act actually expanded the intent, the criminal extent standard under the anti-kickback statute by noting that a person need not have actual knowledge of the statute itself or specific intent to commit a violation of the statute. And for those of you who've been around for a while, you'll remember back to the Hanluster decision, which came out of California many, many years ago about the Shell Laboratories set up by Smith, Klein, Beecham, and a lot of contrary case law around the country at the circuit level as to whether or not you needed to intend to violate the statute or simply intend to do something wrong. And the ACA laid that to rest by saying you did not have to specifically intend to violate the statute, but to have wrongful criminal conduct, to have scienter, to have guilty knowledge. And as we know, this reversed some of the case law out there that required specific knowledge and intent to violate the statute itself. And finally, the ACA clarified something that we knew from the case law to a large extent, that a claim involving an illegal kickback can be a predicate for liability under the Federal Civil False Claims Act that we'll talk about. So again, this is a deadly serious statute, and it colors basically every transaction that you look at. So with that, let me hand it off to Amin, who'll get into Stark and some of the remaining statutes.
Thanks so much, Guy. Before we move into the next session, for CLE credit, the code is 12162. Again, the code is 12162. So as Guy went through some of the considerations on the front end of deal making and then walked you through the anti-kickback statute, obviously the risk associated with fraud and abuse laws in the healthcare space are significant. You know, these are typically bet the company or significant impact to company matters, depending on the nature of the alleged violations. And the Stark Law is no different. So the physician self-referral statute, as it is referred to, officially commonly called the Stark Law, named after Congressman Pete Stark, who was the primary sponsor of the bill back in 1989, prohibits physicians with direct or indirect financial interest in an entity from making referrals to that entity for, and this is a term of our designated health services payable by the Medicare Medicaid program. And just as we learned a bit about the exceptions that exist for the anti-kickback statute, there are similarly exceptions to the Stark Law. And the prohibition on billing for DHS, it applies without regard to intent. And that's one of the most important takeaways here with regard to the Stark Law. Intent doesn't matter. You can have the best of intentions and nonetheless violate the Stark Law. And again, unlike the anti-kickback statute, this is a civil statute. But again, with the strict liability, unless a specific exception is met, creates a tremendous amount of liability. Just as we learned a little bit about the anti-kickback statute, the Stark Law often issues go hand in hand and often form the predicate of a False Claims Act investigation and litigation matter. That is the mechanism for enforcement traditionally. And the ramifications are substantial. Under the Stark Law, you can have denial of payments, refunds, civil monetary penalties, and most significantly, exclusion from the Medicare Medicaid program. There are a couple of terms of art in the Stark Law that you will come across when you're looking at issues related to physician relationships with the entity that may be the target of an acquisition or a merger, fair market value, commercial reasonableness, and we'll get into a little bit more detail on how the federal government views those terms of art as it applies to the Stark Law. It's also important to note that physician, as defined under the Stark Law, is not limited to medical doctors. It includes osteopaths, dentists, podiatrists, optometrists, chiropractors. So particularly as investment activity and deal-making moves into other arenas beyond the traditional medical practice, there is potential risk under the Stark Law. We are going to close out today's program with some recently adopted new rules as it relates to Stark and a kickback. But generally speaking, this is a very, very complicated area of the law. And you know, as you're going through diligence and understanding potential exposure risk associated with a deal, this is where you want to have very, very careful eyes looking at issues related to the physician relationships with the entity that is a target of a deal. I mentioned designated health services on the previous slide. These are the specific services that are implicated by the Stark Law. So when we talk about an entity, not all healthcare entities are subject to Stark unless they are billing the federal government for any of these programs listed here. So clinical lab services, physical therapy, occupational therapy, outpatient speech, language, pathology services, radiology and imaging, radiation therapy services, durable medical equipment, nutritional care, equipment and supplies, prosthetics, orthotics, home health services, outpatient prescription drugs, and perhaps most significantly, inpatient outpatient hospital services. So, you know, historically and traditionally, the Stark Law has captured hospitals and health systems as employed physician groups have grown in quantity and the spectrum of specialties. But again, you know, the exposure risk here is significant with non-payment of services, monetary penalties, exclusion, and penalties specifically associated with Stark. And so the goal here, when you look at DHS and the federal government's perspective on why a law like Stark exists, is avoiding financial relationships between the entity and the physician that has the ability to make referrals to that entity. So you're looking at circumstances where physicians have some form of an ownership or investment interest in the entity in question, and also compensation arrangements between the physician and an entity that does provide DHS. And again, this can be direct or indirect. So when I mentioned the strict liability under the Stark law and the fact that intent doesn't matter, I will follow Guy's lead on at least telling one, you know, war story. And, you know, the circumstance involving a health system where it truly was the best of intentions. A group of physicians involved in treatment for cancer patients, and a financial arrangement and compensation model really driven around reducing costs to both the hospital and by extension to the patients, and further by extension to the federal programs that are paying the bill. But ultimately, both the federal courts and the government viewed the way in which that arrangement was structured, even though it really was designed around cost savings and cost reduction, as varying with the volume or value of referrals to that particular hospital for the radiation therapy services and cancer treatments associated with that particular practice group. And so nonetheless, there was exposure under the Stark law. And it's one of those where you scratch your head and you wonder whether the right thing has happened here. Thankfully, there has been some recognition on the part of the Office of Inspector General and CMS to create pathways for innovation and creative compensation models and relationships, particularly with the move towards value-based care. And again, we'll mention some of those recent changes that were just adopted in the last couple of weeks and go into effect in as early as early 2021, and we'll get into the timing of things as well. But again, I think it's incredibly important for the takeaway here to be that you have to look very carefully at any of these relationships. Again, safe harbors do exist. There are exceptions to the Stark law for arrangements related to group practices, ancillary services for in-office services, prepaid plans. And, you know, again, the regulatory process and the nuance that exists with regard to the Stark law is very high. And so it's really important to have the right kind of expert looking at any questions related to the relationship between employed physicians and the entity in question. Some of the other types of exceptions you see are related to rental and office space, equipment rental or leases, personal services, bona fide employment relationship between the physician and the entities, recruitment and retention. So there are some exceptions that exist there with regard to recruitment and retention efforts. And as I mentioned on the front end, fair market value exception to the Stark law, and also risk sharing arrangements. And again, some of the recent changes that we've seen adopted for Stark and a kickback do really delve into risk sharing and the need for there to be a modernized approach to Stark law enforcement. As I mentioned at the front end, the primary mechanism for enforcement of Stark and anti-kickback is the Federal False Claims Act. This is the one of the primary drivers and tools in the federal government's toolkit for enforcement of fraud abuse. And as Guy mentioned on the front end, in terms of the level of recoveries that has steadily approached and exceeded the multi-billion dollar range and has continued for well over a decade, the risk is significant. FCA, it prohibits persons or entities from, among other actions, knowingly, there are two elements here, presenting or causing to be presented a false or fraudulent claim for payment or approval, and making, using, or causing to be made a false record or statement to get a false or fraudulent claim paid by the federal government. And here we also have circumstances where a lot of states have adopted their own version of the False Claims Act. And as Guy previewed, these are typically structured as all payer statutes. So when you're evaluating exposure risk associated with a potential issue, it's not simply the claim submitted to the federal government programs with the Federal False Claims Act. Under the state False Claims Act, you generally are looking at an all-payer statute where there's exposure risk associated with claims paid by private insurers as well. The penalties are substantial. These are now adjusted for inflation. There was a significant increase in the penalty dollar amounts back in 2015. Current range is $11,665 to $23,331 per claim. And that really is truly per claim. So if you have a circumstance, you know, an example that Guy provided on the front end about hundreds of procedures that were you know, adjusted in the coding for an improper code for the procedure that was actually performed. Each of those improper claims is viewed as an individual claim subject to the penalties. And then you add on top of that treble damages for the overpayment or inappropriate payment that may have been paid to the entity involved. And so very quickly, the numbers can add up. And, you know, a $1 million overpayment exposure is very quickly trebled to $3 million. And, you know, with each claim associated, you've got, you know, upwards of $20,000, $23,000 per claim. That $1 million of theoretical exposure is very quickly in the $5, $6, $10 million range. And that's how these really balloon out of control, and why it's so important during diligence to focus on uncovering any and all potential risk that could arise either pre or post transaction. The standard of proof is the preponderance of the evidence, and you know, applying that standard and looking at the landscape. In 2019, the United States recovered $3 billion through the False Claims Act. And going back to 1986, you've got $62 billion of recovery over the last, you know, 30-odd years. And that $3 billion number, you know, there's steadily been approaching $3 billion for the last several years, and that's really been the floor for the level of recovery that the federal government has obtained from FCA violations. There's also a component that folks should be very well aware of, and that is that the False Claims Act explicitly authorized private actions to be filed by whistleblowers. And I think folks on this call are very familiar with that risk, but just to walk through the logistics of how that works. A relator, who is the quitam plaintiff, is authorized to file a complaint alleging violations of the False Claims Act and, you know, the predicate offenses, perhaps under Stark or any kickback or direct violations of FCA through any number of mechanisms of overpayment or inappropriate payment. And then that complaint is filed under seal. It is then obligated for the government to investigate. So the Office of Inspector General, in collaboration with the Department of Justice and local U.S. attorney's offices regionally where the entity is located, will conduct an investigation. And they will make a determination during the course of that investigation, they being the federal government, whether to intervene and join that matter and take over the prosecution or effectively issue a notice of right to sue, so to speak, when they decline to intervene and allow the relator to decide on their own whether to pursue those claims. So there is, again, a tremendous amount of risk here. Looking at 2019, relators filed 633 False Claims Act suits. And the recovery of the $3 billion in 2019 recovered through the False Claims Act, two-thirds or $2.1 billion came through relator side suits, you know, some of which were obviously carryovers from prior years. But it just gives you a sense of the volume associated with relators and internal whistleblowers of an organization deciding that there is either, you know, a potential for bags of money on the other end of the rainbow, so to speak, or, you know, have raised issues internally and the compliance program and controls internally have not recognized the potential exposure risk of a real issue, and people grow very frustrated. But you know, this is also, you know, in an evaluation during diligence of a compliance program and a company's culture, it should be part of the calculus during that process to be thinking about whether there is current or future exposure from a whistleblower raising concerns about noncompliance. And I'll just add, you know, what we've seen in my experience, particularly over the last 10 years or so, the nature of the relator side allegations against entities have grown to sort of the form of the kitchen sink, throw everything at the wall and hope that something sticks variety. So even if the government were to decline to intervene, you end up with a circumstance where a relator has the opportunity to pursue those claims and perhaps extract a settlement from the hospital or the health system or the other entity that gives them, you know, their desired financial outcome, and it's generally paying the other side to go away on the target side. Thankfully, DOJ has recognized that some of those lawsuits should be dismissed, and when they are truly egregious in nature, there are mechanisms and there's guidance from DOJ to its prosecutors to affirmatively seek to dismiss claims that are frivolous or otherwise will expend government resources unnecessarily. So, you know, there are some release valves, but as a general rule, you've got a lot of incentive for relators to raise issues with 15 to 25% of the recovery in an intervened case. 25 to 30% in non-intervened cases. I'll very briefly touch on civil monetary penalties. This often goes hand in hand with the anti-kickback statute. These are statutes that provide for penalties and exclusion from the federal health care programs for conduct that generally focuses on improperly filed claims. So examples of the kinds of conduct that are subject to CMPs are false claims, upcoding, non-licensed provision of services, and contracting with excluded entities or individuals. So again, during the diligence phase, and the evaluation of the various tentacles that might exist between your target entity and other organizations, this should be on the checklist, is understanding whether there are excluded entities with which your target has some relationship. Also covers false statements. Any application, agreement, bid, or contract to participate or enroll in a federal program, and that includes Medicare Advantage and Part D sponsors. There's also a substantial and growing per day penalty for failing to provide timely access during the audits or investigations or evaluations that OIG is seeking to conduct. So you can see there can be some interplay here. Obviously, it's never in the best interest of any organization to ignore the federal government when they come knocking, whether it's the OIG or Department of Justice, issuing a civil investigative demand or other request for information associated with an investigation. But failure to do so just can start to add up and is subject to CMPs. HIPAA is another area we'll briefly focus on. I know this is an issue that is likely well on folks' radar on this call, but this is the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, referred to commonly as HIPAA. Here we're talking about protecting patient information, and they're particularly in the era of increased cybersecurity risk. This is an issue that should be front and center when it comes to diligence during any deal. HIPAA also established the Healthcare Fraud and Abuse Control Program. This is a broad sweeping program that was aimed at combating fraud, abuse in healthcare, including public programs, as well as the private payers. And the money that goes into enforcement activities is appropriated through the act itself, and allows the various enforcement agencies with DOJ, the Civil Division, Criminal, the U.S. Attorney's Offices, Civil Rights, and the FBI, and with the Health and Human Services Office of Inspector General, the General Counsel, CMS, and FDA. OIG and the FBI generally have responsibility for investigating fraud in Medicare and Medicaid. And again, the FBI has investigatory jurisdiction for commercial healthcare fraud, along with state law enforcement. So there's just, it should be on the checklist of issues, and I'm certain that it is for everyone on this call. Finally, we're going to close out with going through some of the recent changes. Again, just in the last few weeks, were finalized and adopted by the OIG and CMS. These were proposed rules that have been in circulation for over a year, so there's been a tremendous amount of commentary and thought leadership around what those proposed rules would do to, again, modernize the anti-kickback statute and the STAR Clause. And generally speaking, the final rules that were adopted were largely similar to the proposed rules. And again, on balance, not in every instance, to the extent that there were changes, they were generally favorable to the provider side, to the entity that is subject to anti-kickback and STAR Clause risk. So again, these were December 2nd, so quite literally just a few weeks ago. The anti-kickback final rule finalizes a new exception to the civil monetary penalty provision prohibiting inducements to beneficiaries, and the STAR Clause final rule establishes exceptions for certain value-based compensation arrangements, among other adjustments. And again, this is, going back to the primer that we provided on anti-kickback and STARC, where there is some rigidity to both laws, These changes do, I wouldn't describe it as relax the enforcement component, but they do create additional pathways that are in step with the sort of what has been described as the regulatory sprint to value-based care. So it is catching up with the innovation that was driven by the Affordable Care Act and the fact that we're, you know, in an environment now where the drive to create value-based care models was simply not aligned with the these two enforcement regimes around anti-kickback and STARK. So with the anti-kickback final rule, it establishes 7 new safe harbors, including 3 that are targeted at value-based enterprises. So we've got care coordination agreements, and then value-based arrangements with substantial downside risk, and value-based arrangements with full financial risk. On the first, around care coordination, what this does is the safe harbor protects against in-kind remuneration, such as services that are exchanged between the value-based enterprise participants. And it allows that remuneration is predominantly used to engage in the value-based activities that are directly connected to care coordination and management for the target population. With value-based arrangements with substantial downside financial risk, this safe harbor, it covers monetary and in-kind remuneration exchanges between participants in that value-based enterprise model. And what it does is it assumes that there's substantial downside financial risk from a payer if that participant in the value-based enterprise model assumes a meaningful share of the risk. So what the safe harbor does is it creates more flexibility than the care coordination arrangement because there's a recognition that the parties are assuming a significant amount of downside risk. So an example here is you know, the fact that you are taking on risk in order to treat a patient population in a value-based care model. There's, again, some relaxation of what would previously under the old enforcement regime of anti-kickback be viewed as a violation is now subject to a safe harbor protection. And then with value-based arrangements with full financial risk, this fully protects against monetary or in-kind remuneration between the entities that are in that value-based arrangement. And again, it assumes that there is full financial responsibility for the costs and items and services that are covered by the payer for each patient in the target population for at least 1 year. So as you're looking at deals involving some of the innovative companies that are out there right now that are sort of flipping the script on the way in which care is provided, often in vulnerable communities, but utilizing a value-based care model, it's incredibly important to take into consideration that there are some new avenues that will, again, go into effect in early 2021 generally, that may create some pathways for protection. On the additional elements here, in terms of the anti-kickback final rule, there's a recognition that certain entities present a heightened risk for fraud, and they are excluded from the value-based safe harbors. And these are perhaps predictable, but just to go through them, pharmaceutical manufacturers, distributors, and wholesalers, pharmacy benefit managers, labs, and manufacturers of device or medical supplies, as well as medical device distributors, are excluded from being part of a value-based enterprise where that kickback risk is protected, potentially protected by a safe harbor. The one exception here is that entities or individuals that sell or rent durable medical equipment, prosthetics, orthotics, or related supplies can be part of a value-based enterprise model as long as certain conditions are met. A few additional safe harbors, just to mention briefly, the beneficiary inducements exception. This was designed to enhance patient engagement and support improvement of quality, health outcomes, and efficiency. Again, the same entities with heightened risk for fraud are excluded with a limited exception for the provision of technology for patients. So it's hard to go into a modernized hospital or physician practice group or other provider and not see the use of technology. And this opens up the opportunity for such technology to be provided within the context of a value-based enterprise model without risk of anti-kickback risk. The telehealth technology exception, this provides essentially a less onerous exception for telehealth provided for certain in-home dialysis patients. There's the possibility that we'll see further expansion of that telehealth exception, but for right now it is limited to in-home dialysis. And then the cybersecurity exception, this was a big focus in the context of the proposed rules, and it is very much a part of the rules as they were adopted. And what this allows for is the non-monetary donations of cybersecurity items and services to address the threat on the healthcare industry. So a scenario in which technology can be donated as long as it is, quote, necessary and used predominantly to implement, maintain, and reestablish cybersecurity. So a scenario where a larger provider is trying to implement a value-based model and wants to get other providers on board, some of which may not be financially able to ensure cybersecurity protections that would be very much justified in the current environment of risk of breach and hacking. This allows for that technology to be offered in an in-kind way and creates an exception. Again, I'll quickly go through the Stark Law component, and then we'll have maybe a minute or two for some questions at the end. Very similar in terms of the themes, in terms of the Stark Law. There are four new exceptions, full financial risk, meaningful downside financial risk to the physician, value-based arrangements, and indirect compensation arrangements that include a value-based care component. Each of these exceptions require the arrangement to be commercially reasonable. And there's also a new exception that allows for certain payments to be made, and it's specifically up to $5,000 a year without requiring a signed writing and some of the other traditional requirements under the Stark Law, and it creates an exception that allows for those payments to be made to physicians without triggering Stark Law exposure. And similarly, with Stark Law, just as we saw with anti-kickback, there is an exclusion associated with non-monetary donations of cybersecurity technology and related services. I'll focus just for a quick second on value-based arrangements. The way in which the Stark Law differs from the AKS rules. There are a number of specific requirements and restraints that do limit the applicability of the new Stark Law exception. But with value-based arrangements at all levels of risk, there is a new pathway for an exception to the Stark Law. And indirect compensation accepts indirect compensation arrangements that include a value-based agreement to which the physician or the physician organization is a direct party. So again, very similar to what we saw with the AKS in the context of the Stark Law. And then finally, We saw with the new rules some updates and clarification of some of the key Stark Law terminology. And, you know, these are terms of art that have been left open for interpretation for many years. So whether it's in the context of discussions with the enforcement agencies or in the context of litigation, there has been debate about how these definitions are specifically going to be interpreted by the federal government. There's a bit of clarification here with regard to Stark. So commercially reasonable is defined in the new rules as a particular arrangement that furthers a legitimate business purpose of the parties to the arrangement and is sensible considering the characteristics of the parties, including their size, type, scope, and specialty. And notably, CMS added the language, and this is really key, that arrangement can be commercially reasonable even if it does not result in profit for one or more of the parties. Fair market value is also defined. It is aligned more closely with general market value. There's some guidance in the new rules around the use of salary surveys as generally being a good starting point, but an acknowledgement that fair market value for an individual physician could be higher or lower than the survey data. There are regional considerations. There are very nuanced specific considerations for the needs of a particular entity when it comes to the way a compensation model might be structured. And so that clarification is critical in terms of how, you know, physician recruitment might take place. And so, you know, while a group might not be independently profitable, it's nonetheless part of it's a critical component of the sponsoring organization. And finally, the referral, which is takes into account the volume or value of referrals language that we've mentioned a few times. This is, again, it really gets into the weeds, so I will gloss over it, but please reach out with questions. A series of rules that define when physician comp takes into account the volume or value, and CMS was pretty specific here on referring to a physician compensation model that explicitly incorporates referrals or other business generated as a variable component, such that the compensation increases or decreases with the volume or value of referrals. So it seems obvious, and that's certainly the way in which we've characterized referrals and the takes into account component in the context of litigation and investigations. But nonetheless, it's nice to have that guidance in clear language from the agencies that are at the forefront here. So with that, I'm going to restate the CLE code for anyone missed it the first time. It is 12162. Again, the CLE code is 12162. I'm going to pause for a second. I'm going to ask Guy if there's anything I've missed and he wants to add here before we see if there are any questions from the group.
No, I think that was a terrific summary, Amon. So I know we might have one question in the queue, but I don't have anything further here.
Thank you. And I think we have time probably for that one question. And that's a question about the enforcement risk or history under state all payer statutes. You know, briefly, I'll just chime in. You know, I think in the last 5 to 7 years in particular, you've seen an increased involvement of states in False Claims Act matters where, you know, they generally have historically kind of piggybacked on the federal the federal enforcement of the False Claims Act and where there is a state component recovery, they're happy to get that piece of the pie. But there has just been an increase over the last couple of years of of state AGs wanting to have more significant involvement in the investigation phase, in the tracking of the litigation, that they're not the drivers here. It really is DOJ and OIG that are driving the train. But you know, there has just been an increase, and I can follow up separately with some more stats. I don't want to keep everyone past our time, but I will respond to the folks that asked that question. Guy, anything to add on that one?
No. I mean, that's really good. I mean, the MFICUs, the Medicaid Fraud Control Units, have actually gotten, you know, much more aggressive as than they were. But if the question here is whether or not there is a spate of, you know, state litigation, you know, state common law litigation based on, you know, violation of, you know, state all-payer statutes in the private pay context, I haven't seen it. You know, it may be out there episodically. I haven't seen a great deal of it. Not to say that, you know, you should feel free to go violate those all-payer statutes, but, you know, I don't see it to the same extent we see Medicare and Medicaid enforcement actions.
Thanks, Guy. So I know we're at time. We will respond directly to any of the other questions that have popped up in the chat. We really appreciate everyone's time today in joining us. Please feel free to reach out to Guy or me or your Winston relationship partner with any questions or follow-up that you might have. And I'll also note at the end that we have additional programs in this series that will be coming up in 2021. On this final slide, in late January, we've got this program focused on the life sciences piece on healthcare fraud and abuse issues. In late February, we've got licensure and provider number changes of ownership and structuring issues in healthcare services transactions. In March, regulatory reps and warranties and transaction documents, and in April, antitrust issues and healthcare life science M&A. So we would encourage you to keep an eye out for those invitations. We would love to have you join us. And again, thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, thank you.